Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Jets and your Sharks of music, news, criticism, and ideas. I am your host, John Caramonica.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, I'm scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor.
Okay, so you've just heard a little bit of Dear Mama. That's a Tupac Shakur song for our faithful listeners. Tupac has recently been back in the news because he's on Broadway. A Holler If You Hear Me, which is a musical that debuted about 3 weeks ago, open to questionable reviews and is now closing to questionable reviews after a financially troubled run. I am sitting here with the original Slim Thug himself, New York Times theater critic Charles Isherwood.
Thank you. First time I've ever been called a thug, probably the last two, but thank you.
I think by the time this podcast is through, I think that's going to be your that's going to be your new gnome. So Holler If You Hear Me opened direct to Broadway, which is, first of all, that's not a common practice. Is that correct?
Well, no, it's not uncommon. A lot of shows try out, you know, in major cities. Some try out at regional theaters. Sometimes it's commercial. But it's not totally unusual. But I think for this show, it was probably unwise.
Now, this is a show that is not a biographical piece about Tupac. It uses Pac songs as sort of tentpole elements and then builds a rather sort of a well, as you've said, a rather generic story around it.
Right, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the sort of the plot points of Holler and kind of how they weave into the music.
Well, it's about, obviously, the troubles of urban life in the ghetto. The two main characters, one is an ex-con trying to go straight. The other
That's
is
Saul Williams' character.
Saul Williams, yeah, who plays John. The other is, you know, a drug dealer who is also sort of contemplating a life change, or at least he is by the end of the musical. There are ancillary characters. There's, you know, Virtus's brother is killed.
Virtus is the second character. That's Chris Jackson.
Yeah, Chris Jackson, yeah. His brother is killed early on in the show, and the plot sort of revolves around various people wanting revenge. Are we going to, you know, turn to violence? Or are we going to, you know, end the cycle?
We don't want to give away the ending.
The end, it doesn't really matter at this point. Yeah. The show's over.
So basically, in your review, you reviewed the show. You've written twice about the show now. And now with us, this is your third hatchet drop, it seems. In your first review, which went up on the opening day, you talked about the tension in the play between the musical numbers, which you seem to enjoy, and the written parts, the main book of the play. Talk to me about how those two work together and why they didn't feel like they were on the same level to you.
Well, I felt that Shakur's music still has a certain energy. Obviously, it still has a certain energy and drive. And the musical numbers were, you know, where I really sort of perked up and paid attention. The problem was trying to fit the music into a book that was, I think, you know, traded on a lot of cliches about urban life that we're sort of familiar with at this point. And so there was sort of this, you know, disconnect for me in the energy of the show where, you know, you'd have a sort of exciting musical moment and then you'd lapse into sort of standard dramaturgical cliches for a while. I think that was the fundamental problem with the show. If they'd found a better format for the music, a more original storyline, maybe it would have been more successful. And they needed – I think this is a show that needed, you know, a hugely positive reception to succeed because it was an adventurous undertaking. It's, you know, not an easy thing to sell rap to Broadway consumers.
Did you feel like the book of the musical was maybe in some way cowed by the sort of the potency of the songs?
Well, I mean, perhaps. I think that might have been part of it. Maybe a review would have been more interesting or a better way to approach it. But I just think there was a lack of fresh ideas in the book that, you know, maybe if they'd been more specific, it was set in a, you know, unnamed American city.
Right.
Starting right there, that feels generic to me. I mean, nothing happens nowhere. You want more specific detail. And a lot of the characters had the same sort of, you know, vagueness to them, I thought. And the problem is that didn't really mesh very well with these songs, which had this intense feeling in them.
I think it was something that they struggled with. Because there was, first of all, they didn't have life rights to do a Tupac biographical piece.
Yeah, I think that's problematic.
That's problematic, but there was also the thing of, well, we don't have life rights, but we also don't want to evoke too much specific that would make people think of Tupac. I mean, I spoke for my article to Kenny Leon, who directed, to Todd Kreidler, who wrote the book. The reason they put it in Anonymous City is they didn't want to evoke thoughts of the East Coast, West Coast beef. If you put it in New York, L.A. people are mad. You put it in L.A., New York people are mad. And all of a sudden, you're thinking about the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Todd spoke in the interview about this sense of like having Tupac as his writing partner and Kenny telling him you have to be like as you have to like write up to the songs. So I think that was definitely a thing that was probably weighing heavily on everyone's mind of like what comes between the songs kind of be on the level of the songs. And in your mind, that just wasn't the case.
Yeah, I think most critics agreed that it was really the book that was the problem with this show and not the music per se. Mm-hmm. Although I think, you know, there's been a lot of attention, you know, we're talking now because the question arises, well, does this mean that rap is not suitable for Broadway or, you know, urban music is a tough sell to Broadway audiences? Mm-hmm. I don't know that, you know, we need to draw any grand conclusions because, you know, Broadway needs all the fresh blood it can get in terms of music. So I'm hoping that, you know, producers will not be cowed by this.
Do you feel like, I mean, you talked a little bit about in your second piece about maybe the flatness of the sort of standard Broadway songbook in recent seasons and how certain Broadway musicals that had opened with a more traditional, more conventional musical approach also just bottomed out. Tell me a little bit about like what broader patterns are we seeing in Broadway vis-a-vis the songbook and how it's changing?
Well, I mean, in the, you know, the golden age, as they call it, of Broadway in the 40s, 50s, even into the early 60s maybe, you know, popular music was very often Broadway music. You know, standards came from Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. They were on the charts. Then rock and roll came along. And ever since then, Broadway has been sort of befuddled and trying to find a way to incorporate pop music into, you know, traditional storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been up and down. Recently, they've, you know, the jukebox musical has come along. And, you know, we've had all sorts of music. I mean, a lot of it is baby boomer stuff, obviously, Jersey Boys. And
when you say jukebox musical, you mean more specifically?
I mean, you're taking, you know, songs from a popular rock act or pop act.
Mm-hmm. Motown.
Yeah, and either putting them into a fictionalized story with Mamma Mia or, you know, just doing a review or creating something wholly new. You know, I would never have expected that, you know, headbanging 80s rock and roll would be on Broadway, and yet Rock of Ages 5 years later is still playing.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, people are still trying to write traditional Broadway musicals and finding it harder and harder, I think, to make those work unless you have a deeply satiric point of view like Book of Mormon or something.
Is it too broad a question to pose, what do Broadway audiences want from Broadway? You know, you talk a little bit in your second piece about, you know, audience demographics and maybe the audience is too old, maybe it's too white. But, you know, when I every time I come off the train to walk here, you know, I pass two or three Broadway theaters and I see loads of school kids, not like 8-year-olds, like 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds. And I would think that if you are bringing school groups to matinee performances and as a producer and you know that that's a demographic that is going to come, maybe there is a way to deliver a book to those people that speaks more to them generationally. If anything, I actually wonder if the Tupac problem is not that the audience was too old. I wonder if the audience was too young, and they're like, who's Tupac?
Well,
the hell
it's true.
Is that?
I mean, he's been dead now for 18 years, 16 years. I think that was a problem. I mean, if you did a Jay-Z musical, people would be lining up around the block, I think. But it's true that
– And you'll be getting points on that.
Yeah. one would hope. But, well, I think that audience was probably kids, you know, on a cultural outing to go see Phantom of the Opera.
Well, or, sure.
You know, I don't think those – That is not a big demographic.
It's not a percentage
in
wise.
Broadway.
It's not
I mean, no. I mean, people in their 20s and 30s even cannot afford $150 a ticket to see, you know, 5 or 10 shows a year. They choose very sparingly. You know, Book of Mormon has really hit that target because they, you know, the South Park connection. But, you know, I do think they're, you know, the audiences are graying in theater across the board, whether it's Broadway or off-Broadway, and they definitely are doing everything they can to try to engage new ones. Which is why this show, I think, was admirable in conception. You know, ultimately, if you don't have the quality to back it up, you're not going to get those audiences. I mean, if it became a phenomenon in some way, the way Book of Mormon has, you know, great. Everyone would be cheering and looking for the next, you know, rap or hip-hop musical.
Right.
Now everyone's wringing their hands over whether this is a bad sign.
Right, although it's worth noting that there has been some success in the past with hip-hop on Broadway.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we're talking about In the Heights in that case.
Yeah, In the Heights was, you know, a very successful show, unexpected. But that started off Broadway, got strong reviews, had a commanding central performance from Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote the score. There's also, years ago, Bring a Denoise, Bring a Defunk, which, you know, had hip-hop music in it. And that was very successful, ran for 3 years. So I don't think you necessarily need to do any, general statements about why this isn't working. But it's still, Broadway's a very tough environment. It costs, this show, it was $8 million. That's on the low end for musicals. Mm-hmm. So you really have to have all your ducks in a row when you get to Broadway, because if the show is not, a smashing success, it's going to fail. 80% of Broadway shows don't return a profit.
Let's listen to a little bit of 96,000, which is from the cast album In the Heights, and we'll talk a little bit about that.
Oh no, there goes Mr. Braggadocio. Next thing you know, you're lying like Pinocchio. If you're scared of the bull, stay out the rodeo. I got more hoes than a phone book in Tokyo. Ooh, you better stop rapping, you're not ready. It's gonna get hot and heavy and you already sweaty. Yo, 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 I'm sorry, is that an answer? Shut up, go home and pull your damn pants up. That's for you. The Frodo of the Shire, 96 G's ain't enough to retire. Come on, I have enough to knock your ass off his axis. You have
a knack. Okay, so tell me a little bit about In the Heights versus Holler. How they treated the music, how the music wove in with the book, the storybook. What could one learn from the other?
Well, In the Heights, I think, was not devoid of cliches about urban life, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
Go there, Charles. Yeah. Just go there.
No, I thought it was a stronger show in many respects. The storyline for Holler, I think, was too complicated. Too many characters, too much going on. In the Heights was a little bit more focused. But also In the Heights, a lot of the songs, not that one we just heard, mm-hmm. but a lot of them were more traditional show tunes.
True.
Lin-Manuel Miranda has a huge, respect for the, traditional, the Sondheims and the, Rodgers and Hammerstein. So it sort of split the difference. With Tupac Shakur's music, obviously you can't do that. You can't, have insert a sudden love ballad in the middle of, his music. So I think they had a tougher challenge here, and the fact that he was obviously not involved in the creation of it made it even harder.
With Lin-Manuel, do you get the sense, I don't know if you've spoken with him or sort of know from an intention point of view, but was his idea, do you think, to introduce hip-hop into the Broadway canon in a more incremental way as a way of sort of couching it in a more traditional framework and then kind of sneaking it in, so that Broadway audience would be like, hey, I do like that hip-hop. What do you know?
Exactly.
Was it that?
I don't know that it was that, calculated. I think he likes both forms of music and, naturally wants to write in a way that integrates them.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on a new musical, which is going to be rap and hip-hop based. We've heard about Alexander Hamilton, which sounds like a very challenging subject.
Mm-hmm.
He's half a Broadway baby and half an urban kid, so it's more, it's more natural for him to be able to integrate these styles, whereas, trying to, shape a more traditional Broadway musical around music that was not at all conceived to be theatrical is an entirely different and more difficult enterprise.
Is there a version of the Holler situation where, say, it had gone more the Mamma Mia route? One of the things I think, and you can speak to this probably more authoritatively, having seen all these, I'm sure you see Mamma Mia probably like a couple times a month, would be my guess.
I just can't stay away.
Yeah, obviously. But there's, I don't know, there's something celebratory about that. There was the tone of it. Obviously, it's much more up than down.
Mm-hmm.
If you sort of took Tupac's music and emphasized more of, say, the partying aspect of it or the more lighthearted songs, which do appear sort of sporadically in Holler, but use that to set the tone as opposed to something dark to set the tone, would that have resonated more, do you think?
Yes, Bling the Musical might have been a better time.
I'm leaving the Times to go write Bling the Musical.
Well, I think they actually were probably trying to get away from that, because there are certain aspects of that. Celebrating the thug lifestyle or whatever is mm-hmm. probably not what they wanted to do. I don't know, his music much better than mm-hmm. I do. Do you really think a musical that is a big party would work? I guess
abstractly when I look at what Broadway musicals feel like to me, they feel more heavily celebratory. They feel more mm-hmm. Tonally up. And no, I don't. And I think if you were going to do that with a rapper, you wouldn't do it with Tupac. Maybe you do it with Jay-Z. Maybe you do it with Biggie. You know, there are other people who maybe would be better suited for that. Part of the reason I thought it was interesting that they chose Tupac, or not that they chose, that Tupac ended up being this thing was, there's an interesting, almost like a mano-a-mano narrative energy in a lot of Tupac songs that is not typical of a lot of hip-hop. A lot of hip-hop is fantasy. It's storytelling on a kind of grand overstated scale, but there's something very human-sized about the interactions in Tupac songs that I think lent themselves quite well to a bunch of characters on a stage talking to each other. Whereas I think you couldn't necessarily do that with Jay-Z songs. You couldn't do that with Biggie songs. So it was interesting to see them try to struggle their way through taking a scalpel to Tupac songs and divvying them up among divvying the lyrics up among three or four characters, because I actually think those songs lend themselves to it. But no, I don't think Tupac's catalog on its own would lend itself to kind of like a big up spectacle a la Mamma Mia.
But I mean, you know, look at American Idiot, which was based on the Green Day album of the same name. That was not a celebratory upbeat show. I mean, it had a lot of dark material in it, and yet I thought it was very successful. I think, you know, in that case, they minimized the book and let the songs sort of speak for themselves. And I think that worked very well. Here, I think there was maybe a little bit too strenuous an attempt to, you know, create a complicated story to support these songs. I mean, maybe the songs could have been more lightly treated or more, you know, given precedence in a way that they weren't the way they did it. They were an American Idiot.
Well, an American Idiot was, if I remember correctly, was written as sort of as a concept album, written as a narrative.
Yes, that's true.
So it sort of comes built in with narrative, whereas with this Tupac song, it's like with the Tupac play, you're like, oh, we've got to get I Get Around in there somewhere. Where do we get I Get Around in? Like,
right.
It's like, does it in the first act? Is it in the second act? Like, is the car there? Is the car not there? It sort of seemed like maybe a testing the keys in a bunch of locks just to see which stuck. And I think that maybe ended up being a problem. I mean, certainly when I watched it on opening night, some of the numbers felt very organic and it felt tonally, everything was moving at a good pace. And then there were some where I was like, you just needed a place to put that song.
Right.
Like this, because, like, we just all know that song has to be in here. And like, you know, but Dear Mama, which we opened the podcast with, that's like a very obvious good moment in Holler where he's talking to his mother. And that song lends itself very naturally to it. It has narrative movement, it has concept, it has spacing, and it breathes really well, and it's emotional. That's what Pac was good at. But then there are a few other songs like, you know, California Love, where you're like, oh, this is a lot of fun. I don't know why it's at this point in the musical. It kind of could have been anywhere.
Some felt more organically tied to the story than others, obviously. But, you know, that's the problem with writing any sort of jukebox musical, I suppose, you know, because these songs aren't written, you know, to tell a story, and then you suddenly have to make them tell a story, or at least adorn a story appropriately. And for me, they didn't find that perfect mix here, and that's kind of a pity.
Is the Broadway audience demographic kind of like irredeemably white at this point?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you know, you see when Denzel Washington comes to Broadway, as he does in, you know, every few years now, it seems, you know, you get major, you know,
major black turnout,
as well as white turnout, of course. But still, it is overwhelmingly white. I don't know. You know, and I know that when they do shows like this, they do a lot of outreach and marketing. They do what they can. But, you know, I don't see the audiences when I go to the theater. I don't see the audiences really evolving very much, except getting older and whiter. No, they're not really getting whiter. They could hardly get more white.
Right.
But they can get
grayer.
Yes, that's true. But, you know, it's a real problem trying to. But, you know, part of that is, you know, it's not just African-Americans. It's also getting young people into the theater when you're charging $150 a ticket. And they, you know, they have other things they want to do with that money.
Is that business model fundamentally so classist that it kind of doesn't make room for thematic or structural innovation in the form, because you're forever trying to cater to people who can afford it, and the people who can afford it have a certain taste set?
I think that's a major problem. I mean, American Idiot got largely strong reviews, ran for a while, still didn't turn a profit. And, you know, very few shows that really push the boundaries have made it, you know, made a success of it on Broadway. You do have to sort of thread the needle of, you know, trying to find a new audience, and at the same time, you know, you have to sell 1,000 seats a night, 8 performances a week, so you got to have an appeal to the standard Broadway audience. And you know, I don't think producers have really found any sort of formula that works. And you know, that's the thing about Broadway, no formula works. You know, what they say about show business, nobody knows anything, and that's, you know, an ongoing problem. Funny thing is that Broadway still is doing giant business, because a lot of these shows you know, the jukebox musicals and the ones that are based on movies have a built-in brand appeal, which I don't think this show really did.
I wonder, is there a generational solution to this? An interesting conversation I had when I was reporting the piece was with Chris Jackson. He was talking about moving to New York when he was, you know, 19 or 20 or whatever, going to shows and being like, well, nobody here looks like me. Nobody here has my particular interest set. And he said he saw Brian Stokes Mitchell in a couple things. And he's like, okay, well, that guy looks like me. So at least there's a place for someone who looks like me on that stage. But obviously what Brian Stokes Mitchell does is very different than what Chris Jackson does. And then he links up with Lin-Manuel. He's in the Heights. And he, you know, I think him and Lin-Manuel are also in like an improv hip-hop comedy troupe. It's like words I don't like to have lumped together.
That's quite a mashup there.
Yeah, I don't want to ever have to say that sentence again. It's called Freestyle Love Supreme. I think they're going to have a TV show later in the year maybe. But is part of the solution generational? That is, more people like Chris Jackson or like Saul Williams or like Lin-Manuel, as those become, not I want to say elders because they're still in their 30s or their 20s, but as they age in and then the next generation of creative aspirants looks to In the Heights and says, oh, well, that succeeded on Broadway, so I can do something like that. 20 years from now, is this going to be what like an antiquated conversation we're having? Because everybody will have been raised with a different set of values.
Well, I mean, I think an ongoing problem is the fact that because, you know, the pop music today is so distance from Broadway, there aren't a lot of talented composers. I mean, there are a lot of talented composers writing for Broadway, but most aspiring composers looking for success don't see Broadway as a viable enterprise. You know, will that change? I don't really know. Pop music seems to so dominate our culture in a way that theater doesn't, that you have a problem of a very small talent pool you're drawing on. That's what's so great about Lin-Manuel Miranda, that he is engaged by this forum. But we'll have to see. I mean, I would love it if, you know, years from now it's become an obsolete discussion and that, you know, the audiences just sort of cycle through. And as you, you know, get a little more money and, you know, don't want to stand up at a concert for 3 hours.
I don't know what you're talking about. My knees are great. I just want you to know my knees are great.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. You know, eventually you start discovering other art forms such as theater and that Broadway matures along with it, or matures. Broadway evolves.
Well, you know, you brought up the Jay-Z example, and actually what that example made me think of is I think of someone like Pharrell or Pharrell Williams, who obviously is maybe not a performer whose catalog can be turned into a Broadway, but he's a producer and an orchestrator who has a hip-hop sensibility but also a pop sensibility, and also I think is, if not fluent in Broadway, at least is like aware of kind of the big tentpole Broadway things of the last 20 or 30 years. Maybe a producer partners with him and says, write me a young musical, write me a young person's musical. Maybe that's a way to go.
I think that would be great news. I mean, he certainly has a showman sensibility. And, you know, I think that will probably happen. I mean, the way that, you know, Green Day ended up on Broadway is something along those lines. You know, these people sort of reach a certain level in their world, the pop world, whatever, and then they start looking around for other things to do, you know, because they're creative types. Right. They want to expand their audience.
Yeah, they would score films.
So
why not this?
Yeah, let us hope that more, you know, really talented pop writers and pop producers start thinking about doing this kind of thing. In a way, maybe the failure of the show and the éclat that it has somewhat cost will inspire people to sort of say, hey, maybe, you know, that didn't work, but I think I have a shot at this.
Dumb éclat. All kinds of éclat all over the place. So what we need to do is have a meeting between the Niederlanders and Pharrell.
Yeah.
That's going to happen.
You can arrange that, John.
Yeah,
sure.
We'll work that out. Everybody going to holler at everybody. So the last question is, Charles, you know where noble but flawed Broadway musicals go after they close?
Nowhere.
They go to Thug's Mansion.
Oh.
A place where death doesn't reside, just thugs who collide, not to start beef or spark ears. No cops rolling by, no policemen, no homicide, no chalk in the streets, no reason for nobody's mama to cry. See, I'm a good guy, I'm trying to stick around for my daughter, but if I should die, I know all of my album supporter.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. I have been your host, John Caramonica. Thanks to our guest, New York Times theater critic Charles Isherwood. You can read Charles's numerous hatchet jobs on Holler If You Hear Me.
Just one, and it was not a hatchet job.
Okay.
Never mind.
Of course. His reasoned critiques of Holler If You Hear Me at nytimes.com/theater. Check our playlist on Spotify. Our producers have been Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. We will see you next week.
Gangs and Thugs Mansion.
Call me if you're sick. There's a place where life's a little easy. Little Hennessy, we back and cool every hour, cause it's so good. You got the stress from the world outside. Every wrong done.